It's a great benefit to us in the present, but more than that, in eternity, to be here today doing these things in this gathering before the Lord. Thank you for being here, and we welcome those who are visiting with us. I want you to imagine a scenario, and I don't think this is going to happen, but I want you to imagine a scenario where Russia takes over the United States. And they are filtering through the population and taking some people to Russia. They're especially interested in young people who are smart and talented that they can groom to be in their government. And they come through here and they take Jonathan Messer. They take him. They don't ask if he wants to go. They don't ask his parents. They take him. Can you imagine the shock that Jonathan would go through? He's shocked right now because he didn't know I was going to do this illustration. The changes he would have to experience, the adjustments he would make, how difficult that would be. Well, when we open the book of Daniel, which is really at the time frame of the final chapters of Judah as a nation, something like that's happening. Now, that illustration is not meant to indicate that America is like Israel, the Old Testament, or Russia is like Babylon, or something like that. And although I do think that I have probably given hope to his sisters, they'd like to see that deal, maybe, if he's like most little brothers. But that seems so far-fetched. But in the opening statements of the book of Daniel, we see that it's not. It happened. In Daniel 1, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Daniel is one of this group, along with three other Hebrew young men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And we see in the next couple of verses that the Babylonians change their names. Daniel is given the name Belteshazzar, and the other three are given the names Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those were their Babylonian names. They were transported, in a manner of speaking, to the other side of the world. Not geographically, but from another perspective, they were transported far away from their homeland. They were immersed into a completely foreign environment. They had to live as captives, and they had to be subject to the pressures of one of the most sophisticated and powerful empires on the earth at that time. It's a fascinating book. And it's one of several of these books at the end of the Old Testament that has our focus this year. These ancient prophets that have so much in them for today's believers. We start reading Daniel this week, starting on Tuesday. And it will take us well into next week. The other major prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, we are covering these in classes in the auditorium. We're not doing that with Daniel. I am going to preach, Lord willing. I have a feeling that some personal things may interrupt this in the next month, but in the next few weeks, I plan three sermons on Daniel. And we're having our congregational singing on February the 20th, Friday evening. And that singing is going to be built on themes from the book of Daniel. So we're going to give Daniel quite a bit of attention here in the month of September. And the first sermon which contains a look at a sampling of different parts of the book, and that's what I plan to do in the three sermons, is sample different parts of the book, is focused on the subject of the exiles, those people taken into captivity by the Babylonians from Judah, and what this teaches us. So consider with me these exiles from Judah that went to Babylon. There are three stages of taking captives into Babylon. At first, and we read about that one here in Daniel 1, they are raking the cream off the top, so to speak. They're getting some talented people, and they're getting people with influence, and they're relocating them to Babylon that would help them to subdue the population back in Judah. Now, it will intensify in the next wave of captives. There's going to be about 10,000 plus. And then the third action, when they completely wipe out Jerusalem and level the city, there are thousands of people who are just slaughtered. And what was left was taken to Babylon, except for a minority. And so this is the early stages of Babylon ruling Judah and pulling some of the elite into their homeland for various reasons. And what are they doing with these elite youths? Well, verse 4 tells us, they were looking for people with ability to learn and to understand and gain knowledge. And what they do is they teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. They're trying to make these young Hebrew men, and we can really start calling them Jews now, because this is about the time in Bible history where the remnant of Judah are called Jews. They're trying to make them into good little Babylonians. As representatives of their people who are subdued by Babylon, these young men can be ministers in Nebuchadnezzar's court, and they could provide the government with understanding about these people they're ruling over and possibly be a liaison to ruling over them and helping to control that population. This was done in ancient times. It's not uncommon for foreign people to have a role or a place or a job in an ancient court, especially these empires that ruled over diverse populations. And so Daniel and his companions were going to be living in the atmosphere of the royal court. They're going to be operating in the highest circles of government in Babylon. They were not like the average captive living down on the river who's probably having to do menial tasks. They're in a different situation. However, those people living in the hordes of the captives among them, they're anonymous. Daniel and his friends will not be. The powerful people will have clear view of them. They will be scrutinized. And the contrast is going to be stark. They are on the hot seat. Very difficult situation to maneuver. And this idea of exile applies to us too. An exile is a person who's living in a land that's not theirs, and they're usually forced by circumstances to have to live there. And they're living there for some time, though they really don't want to be living there. And this idea is applied to us. In 1 Peter chapter 1, read with me. And if you want to think about a New Testament book that relates to Daniel, specifically the experience of the exiles, think of 1 Peter. There's so many connections. In 1 Peter chapter 1, the apostle writes this in verse 17. And if you call on him as Father, who judges impartially according to each one's deeds, conduct yourselves with fear throughout the time of your exile, knowing that you are ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold, but with the precious blood of Christ. The New American Standard says, instead of exile, it says those who have a stay on earth. The New King James says those who in their stay here. The American Standard says the time of your sojourning. It's the idea, though the translations are different, this expression is that you're somewhere for a while, and it's not your home, and you were pretty much forced to be there. And it's used again in chapter 2, verse 11 and 12. Beloved, I urge you, as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. English Standard says, sojourners and exiles. New American says, aliens and strangers. New King James says, sojourners and pilgrims. All talking about the same thing. People who are passing through a land that's not theirs and possibly forced to be there. That's us. This is not our true home. Once we understand who God is and what He has in store for us eternally, there should be built within us this longing to be in eternity with God, away from this life and this body and this planet, and with Him in His eternal house. And thus we're passing through. As sojourners, pilgrims, we're like exiles. 1 Peter 2, 11 and 12, by the way, is a great theme text for the book of Daniel. If you want to see somebody living out verse 11 and 12 of 1 Peter 2, go read the book of Daniel. Those young men are living that out right there. They are practicing that. And here, the New Testament applies it to us who are followers of Christ, which means we have linkage to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. We're connected to them. They are spiritual family. So go back to Daniel. Go back to Daniel and consider with me what their experience is like. Now, let me just give you this to assist you as you start reading this week in Daniel, and that is the book of Daniel is organized in a very clear fashion, unlike some of the prophetic works. You've got six chapters of narrative, chapters 1 through 6, first half of the book. We see there are some narratives sprinkled in the other prophets, but Daniel, half of the book is narrative. And then the last half, chapter 7 to 12, which is the real challenging part, are the visions that during the years that Daniel was living in Babylon and serving in the courts, that he had these visions about what was going to happen regarding the Jewish people, regarding the restoration to their homeland, regarding the other nations around them, and what God was doing with those nations, and ultimately what God would do when he brought the Messiah's kingdom to earth. And those visions are a lot like the visions in the book of Ezekiel and the book of Revelation. They're very symbolic. So just hang in there with them. They're worth getting in there and seeing God's great plan and how great He is. But it's these incidents in the first six chapters that I want us to focus on this morning. Three incidents that illustrate the experience of Daniel and his friends as they were exiles and how they teach us and encourage us a great deal. Incident number one is actually in chapter one, and it's the first test they go through. We're told in verse 5, of Daniel chapter 1, regarding the elite group that they pulled away to train, that the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Here we're told that they were given both education and nourishment. They were provided room and board, so to speak, and that this was high-end food. It was the king's food. But there was a problem. Verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. We do not know with great certainty what the problem was, but the most obvious explanation is that Daniel, and we see evidence of this, is a very faithful Jew, that he is following the Jewish dietary law, and that this Babylonian king, that his delicacies violated the Jewish dietary law. That just would stand to reason. And Daniel's determined not to eat this food. And his three friends evidently stand with him. And so he approached the steward that was in charge of their care and asked for a test period of 10 days. Let us eat only vegetables and drink water, and then test to see if we're still healthy. And so the steward agreed, and after 10 days, he found that the Hebrews were healthier looking than the others. And so they didn't have to defile themselves. And in verse 9 and in verse 17, we see the key element in all this. Verse 9, and God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. It's God who's helping them. And then in verse 17, as for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. God gave them their abilities, and they stood out. Because in verse 18, we see that they are actually brought before Nebuchadnezzar. That's an incredible scene. That these Hebrew youths who were living in Judah on the other side of the Fertile Crescent, that really they were nobodies. They were talented. They may have been among the nobility, but they're so disconnected from Babylon. And here, just a couple of years later, they're standing in front of the king of Babylon. What a picture. And we are told here that when Nebuchadnezzar examined them, that, quote, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. From the get-go, these young men stand out as exceptional before Nebuchadnezzar. Now, what does this first incident teach us? It teaches us that in the exile experience that we will encounter attempts to transform us. They bring them into this environment. They change their names to Babylonian names. They give them training in the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, and they're trying to get them to eat their food. That, at that point, that was a line. Because to continue to be the faithful people of God, to eat that food would defile them. And they drew a line there. There is no way we're going to live in this world and it be an easy ride and comfortable as God's people. If we ever held that notion that somehow we should expect and we should somehow manipulate the world around us, that it's going to be an easy ride for us as God's people, we got to give that notion up. We got to, in the book of Daniel, that should teach us that we need to let that go. Efforts are going to be made by our peers, by our superiors in society at work or in some kind of place in society, by the media, by educational institutions, are going to try to influence us to think like and act like the people who are not God's people. And it taps into something about human nature. Humans are not comfortable when they're around someone who thinks and acts differently than they do. I mean, no matter how sophisticated somebody may claim to be and how modern and equitable they may claim to be, that's just how humans are. And what happens is humans, when they're around people who are different than them, they either want to separate, get those people away from me or get me away from them, or they want to try to get those people to change and be like them. That's just humans. Now, our goal as Christians is to shine the light for Christ and influence people for Christ with the hope that they will also follow Christ too. However, most people are not going to do that. That's the reality. And we need to learn to be content with being different than other people. We need to learn to be content with that tension. And be on our guard, whether it's something overt or something subtle, regarding how the world is trying to change us. We need to embrace the reality of that tension, whether it's light or heavy, and continue to walk with God, and when there's a line, never cross it. These four young men who are hanging out there on their own in that difficult environment demonstrate that beautifully here. And then there's the second incident. And this is the incident that... Sorry. This is chapter 3. This is the incident that involves Not Daniel, but the other three, the three friends. So if you look with me in Daniel chapter 3, we see the attention once again is on Nebuchadnezzar. Now, you want me preaching. You don't want me leading singing. So you're going to have to help us get that fixed. So the focus is on Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 3 once again. Now, there are two characteristics that emerge about this king, Nebuchadnezzar, in the Old Testament. First of all, he was incredibly competent and successful. Second of all, he was an egomaniac. He was all about him. And he erected a golden image, one that somehow he ordered, he crafted, had it crafted, and it was a large image. And tell you how large it was. About the length of this building, if you took it and set it upright, that's how high it was. Or if you go to the back in the high part of the building and you look up, it's about double the highest point of this building. That's how tall it was. It's huge. And he built this thing and he wanted people to worship it. And he had a dedication ceremony. And he had all of his officials there. Now, for some reason, Daniel was not. But the other three were. And he commanded everybody to bow to this image. And if they did not, they would be thrown into a fiery furnace. Now, we know that Nebuchadnezzar meant what he said. You may remember this, you may not. We were reading the book of Jeremiah over in chapter 29. There's a reference to the false prophets. And there were two false prophets among the Jews living in Babylon that got in trouble with Nebuchadnezzar. And Jeremiah 29, verse 21 and 22 tells us that he put them to death by throwing them into a fire. This must have been Nebuchadnezzar's favorite punishment. Burn them to a crisp. It's pretty effective. Quite a deterrent there about disobeying him. But Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who were now in the biblical text being referred to by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, refused. In chapter 3, verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Now if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music," this was some ceremony, some fanfare, "fall down and worship the image that I've made, well and good, but if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up." Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage over this. How dare these three challenge him like that? And so he had the fire fueled seven times hotter than its usual fire. And the three Jewish exiles were thrown in. And the guards who threw him in perished because of the intense heat. But look what happens. Verse 24. "Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men down into the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' He answered and said, 'But I see four men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods.' Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, 'Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here.' Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps and the prefects, the governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads were not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them." Wow. What a God this is. what great faith these three young men had, and what an idiot Nebuchadnezzar looks like. Look how weak he looks. These three men disobey him, and even when he tries to kill them, he can't. How powerful is he? Not as much as he thought, or others. And it makes him look foolish. But he accepts this because he even sees that there is a God that they serve who is this living God. He has to learn more about this. But nonetheless, what a reversal. And what does this teach us about the exile experience? Well, as an exile, there will be an attempt to control our heart's allegiance. These three young Jewish counselors for the king, as well as Daniel, they served the king faithfully. They carried out their duties. They were respectful to King Nebuchadnezzar. But their ultimate allegiance was to God. Their hearts belonged to God. And worship was reserved for God and God alone. And even if it would cost them their lives, they would not compromise that. To the spiritual exiles of Christ in the New Testament, go back with me to 1 Peter again and note some statements made there. Peter, writing to Christians who were dispersed up into what we call Asia Minor, or today Turkey, which was controlled by the Roman Empire, Peter tells them in chapter 2, verse 17, honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Your translation may have honor the king. So you're supposed to cooperate with these rulers. You're supposed to respect them. But there's a place in you where they should own it. In the next chapter, in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 14, but even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. Your translation may say, sanctify him in your heart. Always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that's in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect. Did we not just read an example of that in Daniel chapter 3? 1 Peter is being demonstrated back among these Hebrew youths in the book of Daniel. They're going to serve the king. They're going to respect the king. But they're not going to give their heart in worship to this king because the idol that he's erected. This is exactly their conduct. We are told as Christ's people to have the Lord at the center of our hearts and allow nothing and allow nobody, even the mightiest human around, to diminish or replace that allegiance. What an example they are. There's a third incident. It's in Daniel chapter 6. A third exile incident that teaches us much. This is forward in time by many years. Babylon has fallen to the Persians. The Persians are ruling this area now, and they have set up, most likely, a regional king. His name is Darius. And now he's in charge of Babylon. But he keeps Daniel on. This is not unheard of, to come in and take over a territory and retain some of the personnel in the government to keep things running. And Daniel's one of the men that the Persians keep serving in the court. And he, as he always does, stands out. Note the parallels between Daniel and Joseph in the Old Testament. Joseph at the beginning of Israel's history, Daniel at the end of Israel's history in the Old Testament, and how they serve in a foreign court, how they stand out, and the rulers become dependent on their guidance. He's a Joseph all over again. His fellow officials resented him. They wanted to get rid of Daniel. And verse 5 of chapter 6 says, these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. Note how that indicates two things. How that it's hard to get a handle on some kind of criticism of Daniel, of being corrupt or doing a bad job or being lazy or being incompetent. There's nothing they can accuse him of unless they can somehow use his faith in God against him. Because they knew that he was uncompromising in that. They knew that about him. Wow, what a testimony. Look what that says about Daniel. They knew his ultimate allegiance was to his God. So they persuaded King Darius to establish an edict, a law that said no one could petition any god or man for 30 days except Darius, this king. Because Darius was like most of these human rulers then, and probably like most today. What drove him was his ego. And he thought that was a good idea. That no king or no god or man should be petitioned except me for so many days. And what this meant for Daniel was, if he was going to obey this rule, he couldn't pray to God. But we're told in Daniel chapter 6, verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. The punishment for this violation was to be thrown into a den of lions. If these rulers are anything, they're creative about executions, aren't they? And when it was reported that Daniel had not petitioned Darius, but his God, that meant that he had violated this law. And the king favored Daniel, and he tried to look for a loophole to get him out of this, but he couldn't. So he had to throw him into the den of lions. And it troubled the king. He didn't sleep well. And then we read about this in verse 19. Then at break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they've not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you, O king, I've done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. Daniel is an old man at this point. And he's thrown into a den of lions, an old man, but lifted up completely unharmed. Astonishing. And what this teaches us about the exile experience is, as an exile, there will be an attempt to stifle or prevent our expressions of devotion to God. It's back to that different thing. If others don't know God and don't serve Him, they're not comfortable with people who do. Now, in most cases, it's not quite as overt and dramatic as this. It's usually more subtle than that. It's like asking questions and being scornful and disdainful and being negative or even mocking the things that we do. But though Daniel was facing a king's edict and being an administrator and a counselor to kings, he knew what this meant. Daniel didn't hesitate at all to express his thanksgiving and his petitions to his God. Never be ashamed of your actions that are expressions of your devotion to God, of your prayers, of your Bible study and reading, of gathering with God's people in worship. Let that never be something we keep on the down low. Let that never be something that we're embarrassed about. Let that never be something that we hesitate and think, what will people think? What might people say? What might people do? Because you know what people around us need? They need to see people who are expressing that devotion to the one true God. Did you see that this king, like Nebuchadnezzar before him, he's learning from Daniel and Daniel's faithful expressions of praise and thanksgiving and petition to God. He's learning about the one true God. The world needs to see and know of our expressions of devotion. And Daniel, he's not going around pointing his finger with some kind of arrogant disdain at these pagans and berating them with angry scorn because they're not worshiping the one true God. We don't see that kind of behavior, but one thing for sure, he doesn't alter what he does. And he's not going to, even if it means death. These are powerful narratives. And we need to get in them so we can get some of that stuff on us. Listen, you fail to read these narratives over the next couple weeks, I tell you, it's like somebody going to Paris and walking down the Champs-Élysées and they're handing out free croissants and you pass it up. It's like going to Bar Harbor, Bahaba, Maine, and not eating lobster. It's like going to Mississippi and not eating fried catfish. It's like going to my mom's house when she was living and not eating her biscuits. You're crazy. Do you know what kind of feast you're passing up if you don't read these? They're incredible. Get in them. And get what Daniel and his three friends had in them, in you. This kind of faith. So there's three things we learn from this exile experience of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. First of all, strong faith in God can help us navigate any difficult situation and withstand any spiritual destructive force. When those of us who are older in the faith rant and rave and complain about how bad the world is, and it's bad, and we rant and rave and complain about how much worse it's gotten, and it has, we do a disservice to younger people. What you're doing is that you're baking up a really nice dose of discouragement and handing them that on a platter. And besides that, how helpful is that to our own souls? That we focus on how bad the world is, how bad it's gotten, how hard it is to serve God. Because what we're indicating to those younger people, and even to ourselves, is it's nearly impossible to pull it off. Shame on us when we read the book of Daniel. Because these four young men, and as they aged, they continued to do so, they were in a culture much more godless than ours. If you don't think that, let's sit down and study that together. Point by point, what that society was like and what this one is like. I'd love to do that. Our society is not nearly as godless as that one. And they were in circumstances much more complicated than our circumstances. They were in a situation much more difficult than the ones that we're in. And they made it because God helped them. If we walk with God in faith, we can make it through any situation that's trying and overcome any opposition on this earth. These narratives teach us that. They also teach us that God puts us where He wants us and where we can best serve Him. Now, there's something missing about these four men, young men. We're introduced to them when they're very young. And that is, what about their parents? We don't know. Were they still back in Judah? Were they part of the captives that were taken, the elite captives that were taken to Babylon? We don't know where they're at. I would imagine they were concerned and worried about those boys. And given the fact that, would you agree with me that these four young men reflect that they've been taught the way of the Lord? They really reflect that, don't they? Because at a young age, they're very dedicated to God. You know their parents had to be concerned about the situation they were in. We oftentimes want to shield our children, put them in a bubble, and try to manipulate the world around them so everything is easy and simple to live for God. Putting a young person in the midst of the Babylonian court would not be something that we would choose to do, right? Because we would fear that those influences would destroy their faith. We would never think to do that. God did. God put them right there, didn't he? It didn't destroy their faith. Their faith shined brightly. Either you're going to serve the Lord or you're not. You're going to serve the Lord in easy and encouraging circumstances or difficult and trying circumstances or not. You're going to serve him or not. They chose to serve him. You know, it's never good to purposely expose yourself to negative spiritual influences, like looking for a test. It'd be similar like Satan trying to tempt Jesus to jump off the pinnacle of the temple and citing God's assurances of protecting his people as reason as to why he should do that. We don't look for circumstances to put ourselves in some kind of tempting situation. Not at all. Yet when we find ourselves through the course of events in challenging circumstances where our faith is tested, trust in God's providence. Instead of, how did I get in this mess? It should be, well, I'm in this mess, but God's with me, and I can serve him. And there's probably a reason why I'm in this situation, so I can serve him right here where God has put me. This exile experience of Daniel and his three friends shows us that though our earthly position is weak, we still wield much power and influence as God's people. There are some mighty rulers cited in the book of Daniel. There are some mighty kingdoms referenced here in the book of Daniel, particularly the Babylonians and then the Persians. And at one level, they appear to have absolute authority. This Nebuchadnezzar, this Darius, earlier on Belshazzar in chapter 5, they appear to have absolute authority. They speak and people jump. They appear to be in complete control. It appears that though at a whim, they could have people put to death, and they do at times. Yet in these accounts, time and again, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6, all the narrative sections, this is happening in every chapter but chapter 1. And in a way, not even chapter 1, because King's like, eat my food, it's the best. And here comes these four Hebrew youths who didn't touch the king's food, and they look better and they're smarter than anybody. That didn't reflect well on Nebuchadnezzar either. But for sure in chapters 2 through 6, the powerful earthly ruler is thwarted. He's defeated. He's taught a lesson. He's even humiliated. He is shown not to be all-powerful. Watch for it when you read it this way. How the king always ends up looking, how in the end, the four Hebrew youths, or Daniel when he's old, in chapter 5 and 6, how he appears. Who ends up possessing this unique power and influence in these narratives? Who ends up saving the day in a way? Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Watch for it as you read this week. And through them, God is exerting his power. Do we see that the real powerful influence at work in this world is God through his people? That's what Daniel teaches. So let's go to Babylon this week. Let's read these and immerse ourselves in these accounts. Let's get near Daniel and let's listen to him and let's watch him and his companions and learn, because there's so much to learn. And let us keep in mind, as 1 Peter connects us in unique ways, that the God of Daniel is the same God we serve and the same God who can work through us today. Brother Zachary has another hymn for us to sing together and sing even as an encouragement for any soul who desires to be a follower of Jesus. And if you would confess that Jesus is the Christ today, you can become his follower by turning from sin and being baptized into Christ and to begin your walk, though it will be full of tests and trials, a walk with Christ toward God that will be triumphant. If you need to respond, once you come as we stand and sing.